So hi everyone and welcome to our first backpack colloquium of this fall. Also supported generously by the Fleischacker Fund of Philosophy at the University of San Francisco, but also the first year seminar committee that has generously supported the attendance and participation of Professor Long in the classroom. This colloquium series offers you interesting, exciting continental philosophers who offer innovative research. For those of you who are first-time attendants, BACPA, which stands for the Bay Area Colloquium in Philosophy and in the Bay Area, organizes many colloquia here and tries to attract sort of a broad forum for different topics in continental philosophy. So we hope to spread the dialogue across different schools, and it's also very promising to see so many students here. And hopefully, if you're interested, I'll distribute. If you want to do this, a little list. But you can sign up your name and your email address if you want to participate in more events that we organize. At this fall, we have two colloquiums, obviously today's colloquium, but also a forthcoming one on Monday, November 12th. There we have Dalia Nasser from Villanova University talk to us on the topic of nature, culture, identity, and difference. So further announcements will be made about that, but that's coming up pretty soon on November 12th. So today we are very happy to have with us Professor Christopher Long, who is Associate Dean for Undergraduate Studies and Professor of Philosophy and Classics in the College of Liberal Arts at the Pennsylvania State University, also known as Penn State. He's the author of Aristotle and the Nature of Truth, and also another book called The Ethics of Ontology, Rethinking an Aristotelian Legacy. As a prolific writer, he has a new book coming out, and I asked him about the title this afternoon, and it's still under negotiation, but as I understood it, it will include something of Plato and the politics of writing, and what else might emerge in there as well?
Socratic and Platonic political philosophy.
Okay, good. So be on the lookout for that book. It's coming out with Cambridge University, and I'm very excited for the prolific nature of Chris's writings, but I'm also having a hard time to keep up with it, because I just finished a review of his previous book, and now the next book is already coming out. So if he keeps up with his speed, I'm going to be in trouble. Anyways, in addition, I've known Chris for a long time, as he's one of the stable forces in the Ancient Philosophy Society, keeping us on track. Also kept me on track last year as I was organizing the annual meeting of the Ancient Philosophy Society. He is its devoted webmaster, and it's a spider in the web, and it keeps the society going. Interestingly, and also very appropriate to the Bay Area and him visiting us today, he has been a leader in using social media technologies to cultivate communities of learning and research in philosophy and the digital humanities. And I'm sure he'll welcome you to join his blog and to check out what he's doing out there, and he'll say more about that, I'm sure, in a little bit. Today, Professor Long will talk to us on Plato and the politics of reading. We will see how Professor Long himself manifests himself as a scholar in ancient philosophy, but not returning us to the 2,500 years ago that Plato and Socrates and Aristotle were philosophizing, but dumping us right here in our digital century, and his talk will be live streamed with live tweets. You're all encouraged to tweet. He'll tell you more about that in a moment, I'm sure. And thereby turning the Socratic dialogue that we're also enamored with into a new digital kind of dialogue where I'm sure his welcoming spirit will reach out to you, and he'll try to practice philosophy in its truest sense, namely in community and in communication with all of you. Please join me in welcoming Christopher Long.
Thank you, Marlene. Let me get the, you know what? This wasn't even on, so that's why we had no power. Okay, this is it. All right, it's on. Thank you. So let me begin by thanking the University of San Francisco, the Bay Area Continental Philosophy Association, which is the hashtag we'll be using. It's right down there in the corner. If you forget it, it's going to stay there the whole presentation. So I want to thank University of San Francisco, the Bay Area Continental Philosophy Association, Ronald Sundstrom and Jared Kuperus and Marilyn Ore for inviting me to speak with you here in San Francisco. I first visited San Francisco when I was 11 years old, and there I am. I think I won that little thing there, or whatever that thing. Had a lot more hair there. But when I was 11 years old, I visited San Francisco for the first time, and immediately I fell in love with the city. The impossible hills, the enigmatic fog, the play of the elements, and the committed political engagement of its diverse population make this city the very embodiment of what I'd like to speak with you about this afternoon, namely erotic politics. So now, before you get too excited, I'm using the term erotic here in the Platonic sense. Eros is love. And although it is at work in sexual desire, it extends beyond this physical meaning to characterize our human orientation toward the ideals of justice, beauty, and the good that inform our relationships with one another. For Plato and Socrates, justice, beauty, and the good are erotic ideals because they are at once alluring. We want them. And yet, they remain always elusive. We cannot possess them. As alluring, these ideals enable us to look beyond the injustice of our current political realities, to see new possibilities of more just human relations. As elusive, however, they forever escape our grasp and refuse to be put in the service of our own idiosyncratic political agendas. So to speak of politics as erotic is to gesture to the role that these ideals play in the attempt to establish human communities rooted in the concern for the just, the beautiful, and the good. But it is also to recognize that these ideals, if they're going to have any political effect, must themselves remain open to the question and thus open to continuing and ongoing dialogue. This dialogue about the just, the beautiful, and the good is, in fact, at the heart of the politics both Socrates and Plato practice. Socrates practices his politics with those he encounters in the dialogues. Plato, however, practices his politics with us, his readers. And this is why I've adopted the rather provocative title of this talk, Plato and the Politics of Reading. Perhaps the title itself has struck you as strange, for on the face of it, reading seems a rather private affair, particularly when we consider reading a printed book or magazine, as my daughter Hannah, far more mature than her 3.5 years, already reading Heidegger in the original German, is doing here. In these cases, even if we think of ourselves as engaged in a dialogue with the author, still, it is very often a silent and isolated dialogue indeed. Yet the nature of reading is, in the digital age, undergoing a rather remarkable transformation. It is a transformation not unlike the transitions the Greeks experienced when the oral tradition gave way to writing and literacy became widespread. Plato was keenly aware that this literacy was capable of preserving the ideas and ideals of his teacher Socrates, even as Plato recognized that something would be lost by putting his teacher's spoken words into writing. In fact, Plato puts this concern into the mouth of Socrates when he speaks in the Phaedrus to the man after whom the dialogue is named, namely Phaedrus. And this is what he says there. In a way, Phaedrus, writing has a strange character, which is similar to that of painting, actually. Painting's creations stand there as though they were alive, But if you ask them anything, they maintain a quite solemn silence. Speeches are the same way. You might expect them to speak like intelligent beings, but if you question them wanting to learn something about what they're saying, they always just continue saying the same thing. Every speech, once it's in writing, is bandied about everywhere, equally among those who understand and those who have no business having it. It doesn't know to whom it ought to speak and to whom not. That's the end of the quote from the Phaedrus. Concerned about the tendency of the written word to calcify, Plato devised a strategy to bring his writing to life. And that strategy he seems to have articulated in a very clear way in a letter to Dionysus of Syracuse. And this is what Plato says in the so-called second letter. There's some debate about whether Plato actually wrote these, but for the most part, let's assume he did. This is what he says. The greatest precaution is not to write, but to learn thoroughly. For it is not possible for things written not to come out. On account of these things, I have never written concerning the things you're asking about. There is no writing of Plato, nor will there be. The present writings, he says, are the sayings of a Socrates become beautiful and new. The passage from the second letter introduces the distinction between the writing of Plato and the sayings of Socrates, only to draw them into intimate connection with one another. The concern voiced in the text that things written necessarily come out seems to require Plato to adopt a writing strategy rooted in the things Socrates says. But this means that Plato's attempt to write a Socrates become beautiful and new becomes inherently political, precisely because everything Socrates says to those he encounters in the dialogues is animated by the peculiar kind of politics Socrates himself says he practices. And that politics involves the attempt to, what Socrates says, speak toward the best, and to turn the life of each individual he encounters toward questions of justice and beauty and the good. So, before we continue to trace the peculiar practices of Socratic and Platonic political speaking and writing, let us briefly turn to what Socrates says about silence in that passage I read before. One of the things that concerns Socrates most about writing in that dialogue, in his dialogue with Phaedrus, is the way it refuses questioning. Each time one poses a question to a written text, it maintains a solemn silence, and it keeps repeating the same thing over and over. Now, something similar might be said about a lecture, particularly one read, as the lecture I'm right now giving you, in fact, is being read. The very meaning of the term lecture is derived from the Latin legere, which means to read. So in one sense, this, what I'm doing right now, is a very traditional lecture indeed. Now, happily, we'll have time at the end for questions, and I promise neither to remain silent nor to just continue saying the same thing. But even now, as I hope you can see, I've sought to enrich the reading by staging a kind of ongoing dialogue between my written text here and the images and slides on the screen. And during the past few minutes, for those of you who have been following along on Twitter, will see that I've been tweeting this talk as I've been giving it. Well, actually, my computer over here has been tweeting it, giving the illusion that I'm live tweeting my own talk. But I pre-populated those tweets. And I want to invite you now to become less passive listeners to the text I'm reading to you. And say, look at this picture, right? You see this guy over here? He's sleeping, right? This is not the kind of thing I would like you to be during this talk. Please don't be like this guy. Be maybe like these people. They're reading along. That's good. They're paying attention. This guy's in awe. That'd be good. I wouldn't mind that. But look at these guys over here.
They're having a conversation. They're planning something over here. These people are talking among themselves. That's what I want you to be like. Whether it's, you know, a little bit of awe, that's okay. But, you know, listening and having a conversation.
So I want to encourage you to read collaboratively with me as I lecture here. And as I present some passages about the enigmatic character of Socrates and the peculiar politics Plato depicts him as practicing. So to facilitate that, I invite you to tweet during the lecture. So basically what I'm saying is I want your divided attention. That's right. Get out your devices and tweet your reflections, your thoughts, your suggestions, your insights to me at CPLong. That's my Twitter hashtag. And using my Twitter account and using the BACPA hashtag, the Bay Area Continental Philosophy Association. Is that right? That's what we're going to use. Get some real traffic to that hashtag. Though I will attempt in the end of at the end of this lecture, actually probably sometime tonight or tomorrow morning, to integrate your questions and your comments or and reflections from Twitter into our discussion here. I hope, too, that a conversation between you concerning the issues I raise will be ignited online. So I'm happy even to hear some maybe a little laughter going on out there. Good, good. Assuming it's not about, you know, something not related to this, but we'll see. So I plan, after our time together, to curate these tweets and the content of this lecture into a blog post and embed a Storify story, which, in fact, if it all goes well, was just tweeted when I brought the slide up, the link to the Storify story, in which I am hoping to curate our tweets, the tweets associated with this lecture, many of which involve links to further resources and further reading, and resources that I've used in the lecture itself. The hope is that my reading here will be enriched by your collaborative reading with me. So that's the invitation. Okay, so let's return then to the distinction that has emerged between the practices of Socratic political speaking and those of Platonic political writing. E.N. Tigerstedt anticipates this distinction when he suggests that Platonic writing always involves a meeting of two minds. In the first place, the minds of Socrates and his interlocutor. In the second place, the minds of Plato and his reader. But that's end quote from Tigerstedt. But the difference between these two relationships is marked by the difference between speaking and writing. This means that if we're to delineate the distinction between the political activity that plays itself out between Socrates and his interlocutors and the political activity that emerges between Plato and his readers, we will need to establish a difference between the topology of Socratic politics and the topography of Platonic politics. So let me explain a little bit about what these two terms mean. The topology of Socratic politics names the site, the topos, the place of Socratic speaking or legging, a space that opens between Socrates and his interlocutors, in which the things Socrates says to those with whom he speaks are shown to have profound political effect. Here, however, politics takes on a fundamentally different meaning than it has in our everyday use of the term. For Socratic politics is enigmatic precisely because it refuses to remain confined within the structures of public institutional authority, in which politics has traditionally been practiced. So Socrates would have been as alienated from what goes on today in Washington as he was from what went on in the ancient Athenian assembly. Even so, however, insofar as Socratic politics, this conversation going on between Socrates and those with whom he speaks, involves the attempt to move and persuade people by speaking words to others in public, even though he's addressing individuals, he's also often doing it in front of a lot of other people, right? It retains a deep connection to the practices of traditional politics. The practices of Platonic politics, on the other hand, is yet more radical than Socratic politics because it is more intimate. For it operates in a space between reader and text
that is rarely understood to be a place of politics at all. Yet this place, this topos, is the very site in which the political practices of Platonic writing, graphein, operate. So the topography of Platonic political writing points to a political place as important and as transformative as any of the great capitals of politics from ancient Athens to contemporary Washington. Its importance, however, has often escaped notice, for the topography of Platonic politics unfolds in the intimate space between readers and text. And yet, precisely this intimacy accounts for the tremendous transformative power of Platonic politics. For in reading these texts, certain habits of thinking and imagination are cultivated in us that are capable of transforming our relationships with one another. Platonic political writing inhabits the erotic space between the text and its readers as we seek together to articulate truth. So just as Socrates works with those he encounters, attempting to turn each toward the erotic ideals that animate his life, so too the Platonic texts work with us, generation upon generation, attempting to cultivate in us a Socratic commitment to live the questions of justice, beauty, and the good. The practices of Socratic politics in the dialogues are oriented by a concern for justice. Justice, that erotic ideal which awakens in each individual a concern for the life of the community and for the ways spoken words can enrich or impoverish that life. Now, the practices of Platonic political writing, because they're rooted in a picture of Socrates become beautiful and new, are animated more by beauty, that alluring ideal most capable of drawing us outside of ourselves and toward one another through words well written and things well done. Although justice takes a certain precedence in the practices of Socratic political saying, and beauty in those of Platonic political writing, both the topology of Socratic politics and the topography of Platonic politics remain rooted in an abiding commitment to both justice and beauty, and thus ultimately to the question of the good. That erotic ideal, which calls our attention to the profound transformative possibilities the ideals themselves are capable of enacting through the lives of those committed to them. Platonic, like Socratic politics, is the practice of erotic idealism. So let's take a look a little bit more closely now at the topology of Socratic politics. The figure of Socrates, Plato's dialogues depicts, lives a life at once philosophical and political. Socrates thus himself appears in the dialogues in ways that enjoins us, that require us, to reconsider the nature of the philosophical life and the meaning of what it is to be a citizen. Because he's shown to live an inherently political philosophical life, the very depiction of Socrates in the dialogues subverts any attempt to understand the activity of philosophy as divorced from the practical life of the city. Right? That's an important point. The dialogues depict Socrates as performing an activity that cannot be divorced from a very practically engaged life of the citizen. We don't usually think of philosophy as a way of being a citizen. And yet, the picture Plato writes of Socrates is that of a philosophical life largely lived in dialogue with individuals. Indeed, the only dialogue that sets Socrates in a traditional political context is the Apology, a setting in which Socrates seems to distance his own activity from the attempt to do political things. Thus, when he addresses the men of Athens gathered to hear his defense against the charges that will ultimately cost him his life, Socrates insists that those who rightly fight for justice must do so in private. Let me read a quotation from the Apology.
Know well, men of Athens, that if long ago I attempted to do political things, I should have died long ago and benefited neither you nor myself. And do not be angry with me for speaking the truth. One imagines that they had a little bit of an uproar when he suggested that. For no human being will be saved who opposes either you or any other multitude and prevents many unjust and illegal things from happening in the city. But it is necessary for the one who really fights for justice to practice privately, not publicly, if one is to survive even a short time. End quote from Socrates in the Apology. The truth Socrates speaks here is that justice is a private practice, to which he juxtaposes a certain way of being public. That this claim is made in a context in which Socrates is provoking those gathered to reconsider the very nature of the politics they practice should not minimize the importance of the attempt to recast the difference between public and private life. If the immediate point of the passage is to call attention to the dangers endemic to the attempt to speak the truth and fight for justice in public, its deeper implication is to insist that even in our most private encounters, the question of justice is at stake. In suggesting this, however, Socrates does not dissolve the difference between the public and the private, though he blurs its boundaries in such a way that a citizen's private actions can no longer be divorced from wider responsibilities to the larger community to which the citizen belongs. Imagine if we took that seriously. It would mean that what we do in private is as important as what we do in public. Socrates' eloquent insistence here in the Apology that justice is not simply a public question of political exigency, but also, and more fundamentally, an idiosyncratic question of broad philosophical significance, suggests that the traditional relationship between philosophy and politics needs recasting, even as it enjoins a reconsideration of political activities in light of the citizen's deepest philosophical commitments. It would be no exaggeration to suggest that the manner in which Socrates subverts the traditional boundary between public and private set him against the standard practices of Athenian politics. Nor would it be too much to say that the idiosyncratic politics Socrates practiced provoked the Athenians in ways that ultimately cost Socrates his life. This provocation that Socrates lived continues to be provocative today. And its depiction in the writings of Plato compel us to consider the extent to which philosophy is itself a political activity that requires us to ensure that all our relationships, be they public or private, are animated by the assiduous, committed attempt to speak truth and seek justice. This is indeed the picture Plato writes into the dialogues of Socrates, whose very life embodies the words he speaks. This written picture is, however, politically subversive, precisely because it refuses to adopt the traditional distinction between public and private on the basis of which politics has been practiced for generations. Let me quote from Werner Jaeger, who appeals to Greek thinking as he articulates the traditional dichotomy between the public and the private. This is a quote from Jaeger's famous text, Paideia. Quote, "The polis gives each individual his due place," and the sexist language is his, just for the record. "The polis gives each individual his due place in its political cosmos, and thereby gives him, besides his private life, a sort of second life, his bios politikos, his political life. Now, every citizen belongs to two orders of existence, and there is a sharp distinction in his life between what is his own," what is idion, that's the Greek word for one's own, where we get idiosyncratic, we also get the word idiot, who's so caught up with his or her own that they can't really be part of a wider public. So a sharp distinction in his life between what is his own and what is communal. Man is not only idiotic, he is also politic. To be a political animal, then, has long meant to be a certain kind of amphibian. is to be able to traverse the clear boundary between two worlds. That intimate world of private affairs in which one is permitted to speak and act as one pleases, and that public world of common affairs in which one is expected to say and do things with a regard for custom, laws, and political expedience. In ancient Athens, of course, only adult male citizens were capable of such an amphibious existence. And a sign of one's excellence as a citizen was the ability to know how to speak and act properly in each sphere. However, the passage from the Apology, as the passage from the Apology about the public and private makes clear, Socrates renders the boundary between public and private porous in a way that infuses political concerns into each idiosyncratic relationship he establishes. Socrates thus subverts the standard practices of Greek politics and the values those practices embodied and legitimated. The subversive nature of Socratic political philosophy comes nowhere more clearly to language than in his encounter with Callicles in the Gorgias. In the context of that conversation, Socrates gives voice to the distinctly political nature of his philosophical practice. A quote from the Gorgias. I think that with few Athenians, says Socrates, I think that with few Athenians, so as not to say the only one, I attempt the political art truly, and I alone of those now living do political things. I'm trying to be provocative. Continuing the quote, for it is not toward gratification that I speak the speeches that I speak on each occasion, but toward the best, not toward the most pleasant. And I'm not willing to do the things you, Callicles, recommend, those clever subtleties that you spoke about before. I will not have anything to say in a court of justice. Of course, he says this in the Gorgias, and that, of course, comes. He has a lot to say in the Apology, but not the right kinds of things to say to save him his life. So Socrates is led to make these comments by an attack Callicles, who is quite a belligerent fellow, levels against the very course of life Socrates had to this point followed. This attack must be heard in two contexts at once, for it occurs not only in the unfolding drama that is the Gorgias, but it also expresses a critique of the prevailing vision of politics so deeply embedded in the wider political culture of 4th-century Athens. So the attack Callicles levels against Socrates in the Gorgias is rooted in the canonical understanding of the proper distinction between public and private that we've been discussing. The private sphere is inconsequential, whereas the public sphere opens the space for great actions. When Socrates references those clever subtleties at the end of that passage I just read, he calls our attention back to the moment in which Callicles first inserted himself into the discussion in the Gorgias. There, Callicles drew on Euripides' play Antiope, which has mostly been lost, but we know enough about it to know that there was a distinction in that play between a person who was pursuing a life of the mind and one who was pursuing a very practical life. And Callicles draws on this to establish a strict distinction between the contemplative life of the philosopher and the practical life of those engaged in politics. And the life of the philosopher, Callicles insists, is spent, now quote from Callicles, whispering in corners with three or four boys and never giving voice to that which is free and great and opportune. He's got a little bit of disdain for this kind of activity. He says it's fine for you to pursue when you're a little kid, but when you get to a certain age, you should give it up. So Callicles here gives voice to the standard Athenian attitude toward politics, in which words are used to gain influence, and the question of what is just is often reduced to the question of expedient. What is best for me or for our national interest? Justice for Callicles and for many a Greek politician of empire comes ultimately down to the ability to compel others to serve your self-interest. Callicles, appealing to the so-called law of nature, insists that justice just means, quote, that the stronger should rule over and have more than the weaker. I won't get too into the drone attacks, but I'm thinking about it. Socratic politics stands eloquently against the practices of that Athenian politics of force, that American politics of force, to which Callicles gives such adamant voice. If Callicles appeals to a law of nature and reduces power to brute force, Socrates points to the nature of a law that roots true power in the ability to speak toward the best. If Callicles purges public discourse of the concern for justice, Socrates injects the question of justice into even his most private conversations. If Callicles divorces philosophy from politics, relegating it to whispers and corners, Socrates renders politics philosophical, demanding that it be more concerned with truth than expediency, more concerned with the good than with pleasure. The Socrates depicted in the Platonic dialogues is a strange and powerful political figure, and he provokes the individuals he encounters to consider if the course of their lives is oriented toward what is just and beautiful and good. So turning then to the nature of the topography of Platonic politics, in my last section here of the paper. If the proper site of Socratic politics is the concrete encounters between individuals, the proper site of Platonic politics is the concrete encounter, new with every reading, between text and reader, an encounter which has the capacity to transform the wider community in which each reader lives. There are three dimensions to the topography of Platonic politics that account for this tremendous political power. First, by calling our own beliefs and opinions into question, Platonic writing opens us also to what is beyond ourselves. Second, by confronting us with Socrates' public failures and pointing to his more private interpersonal successes, Platonic writing cultivates in us the ability to imagine new, more just political possibilities. And third, by depicting a Socrates unwaveringly animated by a concern for the erotic ideals of justice and beauty and the good, Platonic writing invites us to consider how these ideals themselves are capable of transforming the nature of our relationships with one another. Let's talk first a little bit about openness. The impersonal nature of writing separates the Platonic practice of politics from the personal practices of Socratic politics, which are always attuned to and tuned toward the peculiar individual with whom Socrates speaks. Yet Plato undermines the impersonal nature of writing by remaining attentive to the living voice of Socrates as he challenges the beliefs and opinions of those he encounters. Drawing thus on the hortatory and dialogical voice of Socrates, Platonic writing opens us readers also to that which is beyond ourselves. This occurs in our encounter with Platonic texts in a peculiar twofold manner. If, as George Poulet emphasizes, quote, all reading is, quote, a way of giving way not only to a host of alien words, images, ideas, but also to the very alien principle which utters them and shelters them, end quote. In reading Plato, we are also exposed to the most enigmatic originary figure, Socrates, who haunts the writing at every turn. Platonic writing addresses each reader in a way that opens us to new possibilities of relations by painting a picture of Socrates failing and succeeding in his attempt to use words to persuade those he encounters to live the questions of justice and beauty and the good. But Platonic writing can only open us to new possibilities of more just relationships if we recognize that reading is by nature collaborative. In the first instance,
Reading involves a dialogue between the text and the reader. Gadamer put it this way. There's Gadamer in front of all his books there. All reading involves application, so that a person reading a text is himself part of the meaning he apprehends. He belongs to the text he is reading, says Gadamer. Reading thus, and that's the end of that quotation, reading thus can never be an abstract intellectual activity, for the hermeneutical situation demands of us as readers that we bring ourselves to the text, putting our own possibilities in play as we allow ourselves to be moved by what we read. Gadamer's insistence that hermeneutics always involves application is rooted in the recognition that the work of interpretation, what it means to interpret a text, is to render concrete the universal claims the text makes on us. Thus, reading is collaborative in a second sense, for our attempts to interpret the text are always oriented also toward the community of readers to and with whom the text speaks. Be it in the classroom, in living conversation, in writing, or perhaps, hopefully, even online, through something as crazy as Twitter, when we enter into a hermeneutic dialogue with a text, we enter into communication with one another in such a way that reading itself becomes capable of opening new possibilities of relation and community. Gadamer himself suggests that responsive, active reading opens a kind of public sphere. Another quote from Gadamer. Quote, "In actual fact, writing is central to the hermeneutical phenomenon insofar as its detachment from both the writer or author and from a specifically addressed recipient or reader gives it a life of its own. What is fixed in writing has raised itself into a public sphere of meaning in which everyone who can read has an equal share." This is actually what Socrates was a little bit worried about in the Phaedrus, when he said, well, these texts, they get in other people's hands and nobody knows, it becomes dangerous. People who don't know, have any right having them or knowing what to do with them can bandy them about. Gadamer here recognizes and amplifies that by saying what's being created is a kind of public sphere. Writing creates a public sphere. The public sphere to which Gadamer here points is the very topography of Platonic politics, the place where Platonic politics unfolds. Platonic texts are political not because they function as manifestos, but because they open a public space in which we readers are invited to reconsider the manner in which our lives individually and in relation to one another are animated by and oriented toward those erotic ideals with which Socrates himself remained always concerned. Platonic writing is political because it is capable of turning the engaged reader toward new possibilities of relation in a literary public sphere that itself conditions the concrete ways we live in community with one another. So a second dimension of the art of Platonic politics here announces itself. Platonic writing cultivates imaginative response abilities in its readers by confronting us with poignant pictures of Socrates' spectacular public failures and his more politically significant, if more intimate, interpersonal successes. In the Gorgias, for example, Socrates fails to move Pallas and Callicles toward the philosophical life, even as he succeeds, at least on my reading, in establishing a kind of friendship with Gorgias that is suggested of the transformative power associated with a philosophical rhetoric erotically oriented toward justice. And my argument, longer argument about the Gorgias is that actually Socrates the philosopher establishes a friendship with Gorgias the rhetorician to present the possibility of a philosophy animated by words oriented toward justice. The Phaedo, for example, another example, presents the failure of Socratic words in their attempt to prove the immortality of the soul, only thus to demonstrate their dramatic success in creating a community among his gathered friends, committed as they were to speaking and living the truth. So the community of friends that is established in the Phaedo, this dialogue about the death of Socrates, is part of the point of the dialogue. And I'll talk a second more about that in a minute. And now in the apology. If the apology illustrates Socrates incapable of creating a multitude, I mean, he did die and didn't really persuade anybody, or enough people. Still, the apology evokes as well in a minority of those depicted who voted to acquit him, and in those of us capable of reading a text with empathy, the apology evokes a deep sense of the profound implications political injustice has for the individual unwilling to speak otherwise than toward the truth. And to take a final example, although the Phaedrus charts a path outside the city walls, staging an intimate collaborative reading of a written text by two lovers of words, Socrates and Phaedrus, the Phaedrus nevertheless presents a profound political success insofar as Phaedrus is ultimately returned to the city committed to putting his words in the service of the ideals of justice and truth. Whether he's successful or not is open to question. In depicting the public failures and the intimate successes of Socrates in his attempts to speak toward the best with those he encountered, Platonic writing, like Socratic speaking, shifts the site of politics from a grand institutional scale to the more intimate sphere of interhuman connection. Yet Platonic writing, like Socratic speaking, generates a surplus of political power that extends beyond the encounter between text and reader into a wider community of relationships. The reading of Platonic texts thus becomes what Wolfgang Eiser has called a living event. The failures and successes of Socrates present themselves to us readers as opportunities to reflect upon the conditions under which our own relationships with others unfold. Reading Plato, we are engaged in, as Eiser puts it, a continual oscillation between involvement and observation. This oscillation marks our experience of the text as a living event. But it also suggests the way reading is capable of cultivating certain habits of imaginative response. The Platonic text does this in a poignant and peculiar way, for it at once draws us intimately into the drama it unfolds, even as it also refuses to allow us to relinquish our capacities for critical discernment. It draws us into them, but it refuses to allow us to be completely drawn into these dramas so that we lose our capacity to reflect on them. To take just one example from the dialogue, the Phaedo. The Phaedo draws us into the final hours of Socrates' life, amplifying the urgency of the situation by emphasizing the deep human desire for whatever solace might be found in some certain proof of the immortality of the soul. That's what the dialogue is supposed to be about. Prove to me the immortality of the soul. Hopefully it'll make me feel better about the fact that you're dying, Socrates. That's how Simmias and Cabes animate the dialogue. But the dialogue also forces its readers into a mode of critical observation by performing the failure of such proofs and inscribing the drama itself into an encounter between two people, Echecrates and Phaedo, whose relationship refuses to recede completely into the background. One of the things that's important about the Phaedo is that it starts with Phaedo traveling back home and Echecrates saying, hey, were you there when Socrates died? Were you actually there or were you not there? And Phaedo says, yes, I was there and it was remarkable. Let me tell you about it. That's how Plato frames that dialogue, and it's critical that he does so. Because what it shows is that these two people, although Socrates is dead, are still engaged in the Socratic activity of speaking truth to one another. So the text reminds us, in specific ways, the Phaedo does, and at specific moments, that the things Socrates said to those gathered in the prison cell extend beyond themselves. The text extends beyond itself first by anchoring the relationship between Phaedo and Echecrates in a living concern to put their shared experience of finitude into words. They did not, these two characters, after all, become misologues, the danger against which Socrates most adamantly warned. That's what Socrates says, the greatest danger is that you're going to become haters of logos, haters of arguments, haters of speech. That would be the true disaster. I've tried to prove to you the immortality of the soul, and our arguments, our logoi, failed time and time again. The proper response is not to say, I'm going to give up on talking about this and trying to get closer to the truth. That would be the greatest danger, Socrates says there. The attitude, rather, is to recognize the limits of the words we speak, even as we continue to try to get closer to the truth through them. So the text also extends beyond itself, not only through the figures of Phaedo and Echecrates, but also it extends beyond itself by reaching out to us readers in ways that challenge us to consider the manner in which we too might do things with words to enrich our relationships with others. We experience the allure of Platonic dialogues even as they deploy distancing strategies of writing designed to diminish the aura of their own authority. Most writers write in a way that augment their own authority, put you, listeners, in a position of passive receivers of the truth from on high. Platonic writing systematically undermines its own authority in intentional ways because it wants to cultivate in its readers an ability to think critically. So in this sense, the written dialogues function much like the erotic ideals to which they so often appeal. For the dialogues present a figure of Socrates who is, like the ideals of justice, beauty, and the good themselves. Socrates, too, is at once alluring and elusive. And like our experience of those ideals, the allure of the Platonic Socrates is wholly saturated by an experience of his elusiveness. Plato writes the figure of Socrates into the dialogues in ways that require us to experience him as a living an ideal. As a living ideal, Socrates is the living ideal. However elusive, however flawed, and I know those of you who have read him have been pissed off at him many times for being, just insistent. But he is a kind of ideal, however elusive and however flawed, who nevertheless models modes of speaking and acting capable of weaving a concern for justice, beauty, and the good into his relationships with others. Exposing us to this ideal, Plato acclimates us, readers, to the experience of erotic ideals themselves. And Platonic writing challenges us to integrate that experience into our own relationships with others. As we move between involvement and observation, as the text draws us in and brings us up short, our creative and critical imaginative abilities are cultivated, and we begin to learn how to respond to others with a concern for what is just and beautiful and good, wholly cognizant of our inability to fully grasp the nature of these erotic ideals themselves. You don't need to have possession of justice to be able to seek it. The Platonic texts are written in ways that do things with us, just as Socratic speech was articulated in ways that do things with those with whom it was addressed. But writing, like speaking, becomes ineffective if it is not actively engaged. Reading Plato requires an attuned hermeneutic imagination. When in the Gorgias we are made to feel the frustration of Callicles and to experience his deep recalcitrance to any suggestion that his words might be more effective, indeed more powerful, if they were oriented toward justice rather than pleasure and influence, we are taught something of the limits of the power of words to enrich community. When in the Apology we laugh at the ludicrous suggestion that Socrates' punishment for practicing philosophy in Athens should be public maintenance in the Prytanean, right, the center of the city. He says, here's what you should do to punish me. Feed me, clothe me, and take care of me in the center of the city. Yeah, that really didn't work out too well. That kind of pissed the people off there. And we know the results. But when we see that humorous suggestion, which is actually a serious one in a way, we're invited to consider the role that philosophy ought to play in the life of the city.
and to recognize how distorted our political life has become. As we feel the excitement of Phaedrus as he goes off to commit a beloved text to memory, that's how the Phaedrus starts. Phaedrus got a text from Lysias and he was going off to memorize it. And Socrates catches him. He says, "What do you got there running off under your cloak?" We feel the excitement of Phaedrus as he goes off to commit a beloved text to memory. We are reminded of the erotic allure of ideas. And as we learn with Phaedrus how to reflect critically on what has been written without denuding the ideas of their erotic energy, we're made to recognize that the real value of reading is not simply to uncover the limitations and beautiful truths articulated in the text, but to translate the truths found there into our relationships with one another. Reading Plato empowers us to diagnose the limits of existing political realities and offers us an experience on the basis of which to transform those realities by committing ourselves to the difficult practice of Socratic politics, in which the words we speak to one another and the actions we undertake are animated always by a concern for justice and what is best. Here a third and final dimension of the art of Platonic politics announces itself, and I'm here coming really to the conclusion. For Platonic political writing invites us to recognize the need for and the limits of our attempts to speak and act in ways animated by erotic ideals. The erotic ideals of justice and beauty and the good. Again, the figure of Socrates is decisive, for he claims to understand nothing other than erotic things. He says this in the Symposium. I just tweeted the link to that out there for you. And he says, there's only claim in all of the dialogue of Socrates, only claims to know one thing, and it's this, erotic things. Okay. He never claimed determinate knowledge of any of the ideas. He never claimed to know what is just. He never claimed to know what is good. He never claimed to know what is beautiful in the sense of knowing, possessing those ideas. The picture of Socrates offered to us by the dialogues is that of a human being unwaveringly committed to these ideals precisely because they are capable of transforming his life and the lives that he encountered. The Phaedo is so powerful a dialogue in part because it demonstrates the manner in which Socrates never succumbed to the temptation to embrace the pretense of knowledge in order to gain some solace in the face of his own finitude. And it is a compelling political dialogue because it demonstrates precisely how a community of people committed to speaking truth can be sustained and enriched even as they confront the experience of the ultimate limits of human life. The political efficacy of the Phaedo, however, is actualized on a far broader and historically more extensive level by its having been written. Imagine if it wasn't written. It would have dissolved, however powerful that time was. The written words of the Phaedo compel us, its readers, in a provocative way to put our commitment to the erotic principles of justice, beauty, and the good into words capable of transforming and enriching our relationships with one another. Thus, in reading the Phaedo, we are made to experience at once the limits of words and their power to transform a community willing to speak and act toward the ideals of justice, beauty, and the good, however elusive they must necessarily remain. But what the Phaedo performs with us, its readers, each dialogue performs in a certain way with each of us who reads with a willingness to be taught the imperative to speak toward the best in a world in which the best, as an erotic ideal, has been almost completely eclipsed by a concern for the expedient. The inaccessibility of the erotic ideals to which Socrates repeatedly appealed, despite his own deep recognition of their elusiveness, the inaccessibility of these ideals has come to determine our relationships with one another. If justice, beauty, and the good remain forever ideals beyond the grasp, even of those who seek them, how can they in any way enrich the finite world of human affairs? If we can never have them, what's the point of seeking them? The life of Socrates stands against this received cynicism. confidence only in the recognition that by stretching ourselves out toward such elusive ideals, we are able to cultivate a world, if not just, beautiful, and good, then at least more just, more beautiful, and better. Socratic philosophy is the practice of erotic politics. And yet for its part, the political work of Platonic writing involves staging for us a compelling encounter with the figure of Socrates as he puts this erotic idealism into practice. It is a writing designed to cultivate in us abilities to think and speak and live toward the best so as to enable us to bring something of the good into the world in which we live together. Platonic politics is the practice of philosophy undertaken each time we take up a dialogue and engage together in the imaginative activity of collaborative reading. Thank you.